Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Dan Ashley, news anchor of KGO Television, the ABC affiliate in San Francisco, and I will be moderating tonight's program. Tonight's program is part of the Charles and Louise Travers series on ethics and accountability. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our very special guest. I want to say a few words about him. For those of you who know the story, of course, there is much more to know. Captain Sullenberger has been flying for more than 42 years, having taken his first solo flight on a rural Texas airstrip at the age of just 16. After graduating from the U.S. Air Force Academy and Purdue University, he trained as a fighter jet pilot and flew the F-4 for 7 years. He left the Air Force and began working at Pacific Southwest Airlines, which later became U.S. Airways. In 1980, as a Czech airman, training and evaluating pilots. He also was an accident investigator for the Airline Pilots Association. He was promoted to captain in 1988. He is the founder of Safety Reliability Methods Incorporated, SRM, an aviation safety and performance consulting firm. Of course, we all know what brought him to national prominence, that flight, January 15, 2009, United U.S. Airways Flight 1549 with 155 passengers and crew on board, that Captain Sullenberger so ably landed safely on the Hudson River. Captain Sullenberger lives in Danville, California, with his lovely wife, Lori, who is with us tonight, and their two daughters. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger.
Thank you, Dan.
What a great crowd. What an enthusiastic crowd.
A delightful crowd, and they're so excited to have you here. Captain Sullenberger, great to see you again, and thank you for being part of the Commonwealth Club.
Well, this has been, as you might imagine, a year of many amazing firsts for me, and high on the list, of course, would be an appearance and a chance to speak at the Commonwealth Club.
Well, this is a terrific group of people. And he's quite serious about that. I've been around.
I am.
Captain Sullenberger a number of times, and he is very appreciative of every opportunity that this, as he calls it, successful outcome, which is his polite, modest way of saying miracle on the Hudson, has brought him, and there have been many opportunities. What I'd like to do, Sully, is just begin with something that you mentioned in your book, and if you have not read the book or picked it up, it's really a fascinating read on a number of levels, and I want to talk about what's in here in some detail. But it occurred to me as I was reading this that you've had, as you point out, a number of memorable flights. But you've had two particularly memorable flights. That is the roughly 3 minutes over the Hudson River, almost a year ago now. And then another three-minute flight you took, which you begin the book with, when you were just a 16-year-old young man, your first solo flight. There is something about flying airplanes that, for those who do it like you, captures your imagination in a way that many other professions may not. Some do, some don't. Tell me about that flight that day. You have vivid memories. What did it ignite in you as a young man?
Passion. I was fortunate. Like many boys my age at that era, I probably spent a little bit of time when I was 4 and a half wanting to be a policeman. And then a fireman, as they were called then. But by the time I was 5, my path was clear. It was obvious to me that I was going to spend my life flying airplanes. And I was just fortunate enough, actually, to be able to do that. And I think that finding one's passion has a number of advantages, not only for yourself, but for society. It makes you more willing to be diligent, to work hard, to become good at it, expert at it. It's a source of much satisfaction. I know from personal experience how much fun it is to be particularly good at something that's difficult to do well. And so it's made me work hard. That's something I care about.
When you look back at those early days, and particularly that flight as a 16-year-old boy, what do you reflect on today as you look back at where your life's journey has brought you in the air now? When you look back, however many years ago that was, what do you reflect on?
I suppose it would be the line I end the acknowledgments with in the book. My instructor was a man named L.T. Cook, Jr. He'd been a civilian pilot training instructor during World War II. And by the time I knew him in the 60s, he was a man of his 50s, and he was a crop duster. But if he liked the look of you, he'd take you on as a student. And he must have seen some potential in me, and he helped me realize it. So that's what I think about.
As you grew up in Texas, tell me a little bit about the Texas upbringing back in the 50s. What resonated with you? What has stayed with you your whole life from that upbringing?
Oh, I suppose those of us who consider ourselves Texans, and we always are, even if we end up living in California much of our lives, is that we think of there being certain quintessential values of being a Texan, a sense of self-reliance, of independence, and yet at the same time a very strong sense of community. And I talk in the book about how in the old days, which I think certainly for my children is any time before they were born, but I suppose I would appropriate that term and make it to mean any time before I was born. In the frontier days, where the neighbors, if there were any, they were so far apart that it took some time to travel, you had to solve your own problems first. You couldn't immediately call for help from organized forces somewhere else. You had to at least get the help started yourself while you signaled your neighbors to come help you with it, and I think that that sense still exists.
A self-reliance.
Yeah, just taking care of your own problems as much as possible, being self-sufficient.
All right. And here initially, we're going to birdwalk a little on a few topics, and then I want to focus in. But I know you have answered this question 1,000 times, and people are here because they know the story and it means something to them. But if you would just revisit part of that day in January when you took off and suddenly hit that big flock of birds. You had told me previously that you had flown your entire career without an incident anywhere near that serious, and really never expected to encounter an incident that serious because it is uncommon.
Right, it is, and especially now. I mean, aviation has become so ultra-safe, commercial aviation has, that it's possible for an airline pilot to go through an entire career now and never experience the failure of even a single engine. And that was the record I was on track to achieve before that day. And I think part of me expected that to continue. Yeah. And this, even this flight was completely normal. It was unremarkable in every way for the first 100 seconds. And then everything changed in an instant. And I knew it in an instant. I knew in seconds that this was going to be the most challenging day of my life. That I knew that we'd be fighting for our lives. And I had 208 seconds to solve the problem.
And what altitude were you when you hit the birds?
We were just under 3,000 feet. And, of course, we were in a nose-high climb attitude. And as soon as the engines failed, the nose was still up, so our airspeed began to decay. But we began to coast upward to just over 3,000 feet by the time the nose was lowered to attain a glide speed.
I remember, it may have been you, but I think it was your co-pilot, Jeffrey Skiles, said at the time or in the weeks afterward that he fully, because it was such a shocking event, he fully expected the engines to restart because that typically seems to be what happens. Was it a surprise that the engines just would not restart?
No, I never thought that they would, but I knew that we had to try. From the way they sounded, there were three things I sensed immediately. After the bird struck us, and I should backtrack a moment. When the bird struck us, it was the enormity of the
thumps and thuds that were nearly simultaneous all over the airplane, from wingtip to wingtip, to the nose just below the cockpit windows, of course, in the engines. But as soon as we struck them, it was obvious to me from the things I heard, from the things I felt, and from eventually, after a few seconds, what I smelled, it was obvious to me that the birds had injured the engines, probably damaged them irreparably. And then within a few seconds after that, I had what I described, in fact, one of my chapter titles is Sudden, Complete, Symmetrical. That was how I described the loss of thrust. And it felt like the bottom had fallen out of our world. And I knew immediately that it was a dire emergency at that low an altitude and low airspeed over one of the most densely populated areas on the planet. It was going to be a challenge of my life.
Is there, this was at roughly 3,000 feet, is there a ceiling at which this would have been even more treacherous had you been only 2,000 feet or 1,500? Is there a point at which it would just be impossible to have saved the plane? Or exceptionally difficult to save the plane?
Yes. The sooner after takeoff it had happened, the more challenging it would have become, until at some point it would have been very difficult immediately after takeoff. We would have ended up in Flushing Bay. And, of course, even if we'd managed to quickly land, that would have been difficult in itself. But then the rescue forces in Flushing Bay would have been a mere fraction of what were in the Hudson.
A question from our audience. While you were successfully landing on the Hudson, what were you making sure didn't happen? You talked about it in the book. You've talked about it in interviews, to make sure the wings didn't touch the water first and some of the things you wanted to be sure you could accomplish. In other words, what could have happened if you were not successful in landing on the Hudson? If you couldn't make it to the Hudson, what was likely to happen? Were the other options? I know Teterboro wasn't one.
There were three options. And in order, as I considered and then eventually rejected them, they were returning to LaGuardia, going to Teterboro in New Jersey, or the Hudson. And I rejected returning to LaGuardia as being problematic. I just wasn't sure I could do it, and I had to be sure, because it would have been an irrevocable choice. Turning back toward the airport across the Bronx would have ruled out every other option. And missing it even by feet could well have been catastrophic, not only for everyone on the airplane, but for persons on the ground. To return to the runway would have required being able to lower the landing gear. It would have been, and I did not know at that point if we'd been able to, it would have meant abandoning sooner the attempt to restart the engines and going to another checklist to lower by alternate means the landing gear. It would have meant configuring the airplane with flaps and slats to be able to slow enough to a normal landing speed for the runway. It would have meant turning so as to be able to manage our speed, altitude, and direction precisely enough to align the flight path with the runway to have a survivable touchdown that was not too steep, that it would damage the airplane on landing, break it open, and cause a post-crash fire. It would have meant maintaining directional control to remain on the runway while attempting to stop, and it would have meant being able to use the wheel brakes, which I also did not know if I'd be able to do, to stop prior to departing the end of the runway. So for a variety of reasons, in many ways, it would have been more challenging, and the penalty for being wrong would have been quite severe. The alternative to that would have been attempting to reach Teterboro Airport across the Hudson in New Jersey. But after less than a minute of considering that and having the air traffic controller, whose voice you've heard on the tapes, Patrick Harden, try to arrange that for us, I saw it rising in the windshield, a sure sign to every pilot that it's too far, that it's unattainable. So the only option, the only remaining choice for us, the only place in the entire metropolitan area long enough, wide enough, smooth enough, even to attempt landing a modern large jet airliner was the river.
In 208 seconds, you had to process an enormous amount of information. Yeah, most of us have a hard time ordering lunch.
I think I spent more time describing that than it took to do it.
You have said in the past, in fact, I think you told me in one interview, that you believe any pilot with proper training could have done that, could have made a successful landing on the Hudson. I know you're a very gracious and modest man. Is that true? I mean, is that really true?
Or I think what was difficult about this situation was that it was so unanticipated. I think in an analogous fashion to our wonderful hindsight after major events like the September 2001 terror attacks, we now have means of preventing that from happening. We now have effective means of dealing with it if it were to happen again. In a similar fashion, I think that armed with our hindsight now, there are many who could have replicated our performance that day. There are many, and it's unknowable how many that is, who could have done it that day, having it still be unanticipated, mm-hmm. and with the severe startle factor, which was significant. But I think that a similar outcome could have been achieved.
One of the things that I know all of us have been impressed with, and I have heard the words, I've told you this before, I've heard the words many times in my head, we're going to be in the Hudson. Do you remember hearing those words calmly? And I guess we all would like to know that we would be as calm in a crisis. I doubt that I would, and I don't know how many of us would. One of the things beyond training and controlling your space in that cockpit, I suppose, is controlling your emotions and controlling your mind. I know we have a saying in broadcasting that the mind is a magnificent tool. It starts working the moment you're born and stops the second the red light comes on. I've been in those situations where it just stopped working at the wrong moment. How do you... I guess it's all instinct. You don't have time, really, to control your emotions. I mean, do you just react reflexively, or is there something else?
You know, it was not automatic. It was not instinctive. It was a conscious choice, and it was difficult to do. I could feel my body's natural human physiological response, my stress response, my adrenaline surge intensely at the moment it was happening. I was aware of it while it was happening. I could feel it intensely to my core. It was the most intense reaction of my life. But I knew I had to do my job in spite of it. I knew that I had to set it aside, to compartmentalize. And that's something professional pilots are trained to do. But it was difficult. I mean, it was distracting. But it didn't keep us from doing what we had to do. It probably made it harder for us to do what we had to do. We probably would have done better had we not been so startled.
Sure.
But you do what you have to do, and that's what we're trained for. But it required conscious effort, and it was distracting throughout the remainder of the flight. My pulse in the hospital hours later was still over 100, and it was that way for a week.
Really?
My blood pressure was 160 over 100 for days, and it's normally 110 over 70. It took a while for mm-hmm. that to take place. And I still remember distinctly not only when that began seconds after the thrust loss, but I remember when it ended, and that was about 4 hours later as we were waiting in the hospital for news of what the final tally would be and the fact that finally we found out that all 155 people were accounted for and safe. And about that time, I could feel my body, you know, that shut down, that stop, that stress reaction finally finish, or exhaust itself, however you want to say it.
Let's talk briefly, if we can, about something else you write quite a bit about in the book, which, to me, reading, was one of the more emotional aspects of this story, and that is the courageous behavior of not just you, but the entire flight crew, and many of the passengers mm-hmm. in those minutes after the plane hit the Hudson. It's really quite powerful to read the story of what was happening, the back of the plane filling up with water, people moving forward. And you described it, as someone else, I guess, described it at the time, as controlled panic, but it was controlled. And people really behaved, I thought, quite admirably. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think they said it was orderly chaos. I think that several things were going on. First, I heard later that after the thrust loss, while we were gliding toward the river, that the sense of the passengers in the cabin was that the airplane was actively being flown, that someone was controlling it, and that it felt, in a sense, like a normal approach to an airport, the descending flight toward landing. It was quiet. There wasn't much engine noise, and there wasn't much conversation in the cabin, I'm told. In fact, one of the flight attendants said that it was as quiet as a library. And they were waiting to see what was going to happen. They were waiting for word and I had only time to make that one announcement, which I'm sure you've all heard. But I think that we had very highly trained, very experienced flight attendants who exhibited, you know, a professional, calm demeanor, and the passengers responded in kind. I think we also had the huge advantage of having some savvy, mostly business travelers who fly a lot. They know how things work. They knew what needed to be done, and they all worked together in a really cooperative way. So I think that while they may have been very concerned, and many of them were making peace with what they thought was going to be their deaths, I think that they were willing to work together. And when we landed and the airplane was intact and we were floating and we were all still alive, I think that some of them tell me they felt elation. And then they began to move quickly toward the exit and help each other get out, along with the flight attendants, of course.
And you and your co-pilot, Jeff Skiles, apparently right after impact, looked at one another and almost simultaneously, I'll let you tell the story, but it was a bit of a surprise.
We didn't know what to expect. We had never landed an airliner in the river before. And that was one of the reasons I said the words I did in that one announcement to the cabin, because I did not yet know how well I'd be able to trade some of our forward speed for a reduced rate of descent to cushion the landing. And so I chose my words very carefully, and I probably extravagantly used some of those 208 seconds to take 3 or 4 seconds to choose my words. And I said, "This is the captain, brace for impact." And I used the word brace because in our airline, that has specific meaning. That triggers the flight attendants in the cabin to shout their commands. And I used the word impact because I thought it would be a hard landing, and in fact it was, harder in the back than in the front. And I wanted people to be bracing to avoid injury during the landing and not being, you know, up, moving around, or reaching under the seat to get the life vest or something else. As soon as we did stop and landed in the river and came to a rest, and it was obvious to at least those of us in the cockpit that the airplane was probably intact, that we were floating, and that everyone was probably still alive, Jeff and I took a couple of seconds before we began the evacuation duties and looked at each other and almost in the same words at the same time said, "Well, that wasn't as bad as I thought." We were in no mood, nor did we have time to celebrate, but it was just a bit of a release of tension because we had solved the first and the biggest problem of the day. But we hadn't solved the whole problem yet.
Biggest problem being get the plane safely on the ground.
Yeah, and so I was confident that based upon my experience, I could find a way to deliver the aircraft to the surface intact. And I knew if I did that, then the flight attendants could evacuate the airplane and the rescue could begin. But it was a series of step-by-step problem-solving exercises, and we had solved the biggest one, but we hadn't gotten everybody safely out of the river yet.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Captain Chesley Sullenberger, the commercial pilot who safely and amazingly landed his plane in New York's Hudson River in January of this year, nearly 1 year ago now. Sully, before we move on to some other things, part of the story that has some lore to it because it was so level-headed and so courageous, you walked the cabin twice. And you write in the book, toward the back of the plane, by the time you got there, you're now in waist-deep water, shouting to make sure that everyone came forward and that everyone was off the plane. And then even after that, you ran back into the cockpit to grab an overcoat and the maintenance log. Is that right?
Yes. And I got the emergency locator transmitter from the cabin, which is also a procedure. I had time to do all those things, and I wanted to use the time to the greatest benefit. And I sensed that the airplane was stable. It was not going to suddenly sink. It was taking on water, but at a rate that was, gave us time to get everybody off. And so I could leave no possibility of anyone being left behind. And I felt like I'd gotten them this far. I certainly wasn't going to stop now and leave somebody behind when we'd gotten so close to getting everyone off.
When you found out that all 155 passengers and crew were safe, describe your sense of relief, because this part of it was very personal for you. You have said that had anyone not made it, you probably would not have accepted any or many of these various opportunities.
We couldn't have. We couldn't have celebrated as it was. We didn't feel like celebrating that night. We were spent. We were used up. We'd been through a traumatic exercise, but had even one person not survived, we couldn't have celebrated any of this. I couldn't have. But
when you realized everyone was,
it was
safe.
About 4 hours after we landed. I was in the hospital still waiting to go to the next place after we'd been evaluated, and I'd been asking for hours, "What's the number? What's the count?" Yeah, and I wasn't getting definitive answers, and part of it was complicated by two factors. First, passengers and others were being taken to both sides of the river, to the New Jersey side and the Manhattan side. They were delivered there by different means. Some had gone to hospitals, some had not. Some had actually tried to get on another flight and go home, and did.
Can you imagine? Yeah,
some got back on a U.S. Airways flight and went on to Charlotte. And that's how much faith they had in us because of what we had done to save their lives. But so it took hours. It also was difficult because it took some time to create a manifest. You see, on domestic flights, a manifest is never given to the crew, only for international flights. And so it took some time for the airline to create a manifest from the electronic records of the flight. Mm-hmm. So for all these reasons, it took almost 4 hours until it was finally apparent.
Was that a very difficult period of time for you?
Absolutely. I couldn't rest. I was just dying to find out, and I had to know the answer. And finally, about 4 hours after it happened, I finally got the word. And one of our U.S. Airways captains came up to me in the hospital. He's one of our union reps and said, "It's official." And that was the moment I could relax.
You write in the book, Highest Duty, that it was a period of time, weeks, maybe months, before you fully were able to process what happened to you. I mean, you did, after all, go through a traumatic stress. Describe, were you aware during that period that you had gone through something and that you yourself still were working through a process?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, one of the things that both our pilots union and I had done that turned out to be very beneficial was that we insisted that the entire crew get the very next day, Friday, January 16th, a chance to talk to our union's critical incident response people. We have volunteer peers who do the same job that we do, who are specially trained to give us a roadmap. And I asked for a roadmap of what to expect. You know, how is it going to be? And they told us, you know, distracted thoughts, inability to sleep more than a few hours at a time, a loss of appetite, second-guessing, what-ifing, all these kinds of things. And it's exactly what happened to each of us. And so we, all five of us in the crew, went through that together and got a handle on what to expect. But it took time. It took time to put it all in perspective. I think I had the advantage of being 57, almost 58 years old when this happened, so I had lots of life experience to help me put this in perspective. But it took time to put it in perspective and to integrate this into my psyche so I could make sense of it.
Are you there? Has that happened?
Oh, yeah. That happened quickly, within a few months. And I think what helped also is that the investigation basically verified that Jeff Skiles and I did have an accurate understanding of the situation, that we did take proper actions and make appropriate choices at every juncture, that we really did have done, we really had done the best that we could do with the situation that we faced and the time in which we had to deal with it. And that helped immensely. But yeah, it took some time to get through this because, I mean, you know, we landed an airplane full of people in a river. And it was a traumatic experience.
It must be gratifying, of course, that everyone was saved, and gratifying to know that as a professional pilot, and as a professional, one always wants to act professionally, you literally made, to my knowledge, you and the crew, every right decision, given the set of circumstances. That's really quite an amazing achievement in 208 seconds.
You know, we were
all those lives on the line,
and I'm also especially proud. And one of the things I talk about in the book is the day in early June, where my first officer that day, Jeffrey Skiles, and I had a chance for the first time to listen to the other recording. What you've all heard is the recording of the air traffic control radio communications between the controller Patrick Hardin and our flight. What you haven't heard, and you can't because it's prohibited by law, is to be used only for investigation purposes, although there's a transcript in one of the appendices of the book, is the cockpit voice recording. And when Jeff and I first heard that at the NTSB headquarters in Washington in June, it was shocking. I didn't think that time had slowed down, my perception of time had slowed down during the event, because it happened quickly. I didn't feel like it was in slow motion. But when I heard the recording for the first time of what actually did happen and how quickly it happened, it was even faster than I remembered. It was just breathtaking. It was shocking. It was hard to believe that it had happened as fast as it really did. So I was, at the end, especially gratified and very proud of what Jeff and I had been able to do in such a short time, facing such long odds. And, of course, as a student of safety and being interested in what's gone before and trying to learn not only from my experiences but the experiences of others, I've read many such transcripts after major accidents. And ours sounded really good in terms of our competence. We didn't sound confused. We sounded busy.
And clear-headed.
And so I was happy with what we accomplished that day.
I'm going to shift a little. I want to talk toward the end of the program, Sully, with your permission, about your thoughts on where we are today and what you have, how this has changed your life and your family's life. I'll kind of end that, but let's turn quickly to some questions that the audience has about airlines in general. This is from the audience. Can you share your thoughts on the overall safety of air travel? Are American Airlines adequately preparing pilots and ensuring that they have skill sets for unforeseen crisis situations?
Aviation, commercial aviation, is ultra safe. It's safe and getting safer. If you travel on a major North American, European, Western Pacific carrier, you're at the highest level you can be. The chances of being in an aircraft accident now as a passenger are astronomical. There are hundreds of thousands of people dedicated every day to do their best to keep it that way. I do have some concerns. One of the things I'm concerned about is that we not rely upon the investments made by previous generations to keep aviation being safe. We have to renew that investment. We have to make new investments going forward in order to keep aviation getting safer and safer. And when those investments must be not only in technology, not only in the system in which we operate, they must be in people. People are the key ingredient here. No airplane can fly itself. And there's no substitute for fundamental skills that are well learned, for in-depth knowledge, not only of the flying of the airplane, but of its component systems. And especially now in terms of high technology and automation, those skills must be learned on top of the basic flying skills and on top of the airplane systems. So I think it's doubly important that we make sure that the next generation of pilots has learned those skills and has the kind of judgment that can come only from long experience. Now, there are ways to do that. I just hope that we choose to. My other concern is that much of what people are going through in general now, the last couple of years with all this financial meltdown, airline employees have been living with for 8 years or more, certainly since the September 2001 terror attacks. Airline bankruptcies, draconian pay cuts, losing half your pay, all of your pension, longer work hours. It makes me wonder if going forward we're still going to be able to attract the best and brightest, people who are willing to be passionate about something that matters, to care about it, and to work very hard at becoming expert at it. Or will they choose some other approach? Will they choose law or finance or medicine instead? And I think those are important questions. And the other concern I have is that one of the ways historically that we've been able to make aviation so ultra safe is that the airline companies have chosen to greatly exceed the regulatory minimums in almost every area, in maintenance, in training, in scheduling. And I think now what we're seeing with this intense cost pressure at all the companies is a tendency to cheapen everything as much as possible. And my concern is that the people leading our companies are primarily trained in finance, and there's certainly a need for that. But I think that if the decisions that they make are too far removed from the everyday real-world consequences of the people using those tools and living with the effects of those decisions, then we may have in some way degraded these margins above the regulatory minimums that we've relied on for so many generations to keep aviation becoming better. So we need to do two things. Make sure that the regulatory minimums really are adequate, because historically we haven't had to rely upon the minimums before. We've always had people willing to do more than that. And second, I think we need to be willing to make the investments it takes to maintain those margins.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club. The Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Captain Chesley Sullenberger, the commercial pilot who safely landed his plane in New York's Hudson River earlier this year. Captain Sullenberger, from the audience, as a working airline captain, could you please share your opinion about major airlines outsourcing aircraft repairs and maintenance to countries outside the United States? Is this an issue in your mind?
Yes. I think it just follows that comparing a situation where you have a third party, sometimes a fourth party vendor, doing work in a distant location using technical documents that must be complied with exactly, sequentially, correctly, written in English, in a situation where English is not the first language of the technicians doing the jobs, it's much more difficult to be as confident of the outcome, not only in maintaining and repairing aircraft structures, but in their component systems. I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm just saying it's harder, and you have to work harder at ensuring that it's done properly every time. And my personal experience tells me that it's a concern. And it's another unintended consequence of a decision made on economic grounds. One of the things I think that will serve us best as our society goes forward into the future is that we go to the next level of safety, which is to require, and airlines are choosing to do this now, that safety become a core function of everyday business, and that management at every level be held responsible and accountable for making safety as important as financial considerations.
And you believe that is the case now, or is that changing?
That is something that we are working toward. There is a system called Safety Management Systems, or SMS, that some airlines are choosing to implement. I think it may become a regulatory mandate at some point in this country and around the world. And one of the things it will require, if it's done properly, is what I've just talked about.
Right. Sully, how does our aviation system and airlines compare to those of other countries in terms of safety?
Oh, very good. Like I said, if you're traveling on a major North American or European or Western Pacific carrier, you're at the highest levels.
Are we higher than European? Not necessarily. They're all comparable.
The ones that are not as good are the other areas, the former Soviet Union, Africa, parts of Southwest Asia.
Is there something, you were in an Airbus that day, right?
Yes.
This is part of a question from the audience. Is there something about that Airbus that made it, gave you a better opportunity to have a successful outcome, the fly-by-wire?
The short answer is it's a mixed blessing. I think we would have had a similar outcome with a different, more conventional airplane, a Boeing 737, for example. What a fly-by-wire flight control system on an airliner will do for you is it will protect pilots from exceeding certain maximums in terms of maneuvering the airplane. A fly-by-wire computer control system, like in the Airbus, will prevent a pilot, no matter how hard he or she pulls on the control stick, from breaking the airplane. You can't pull the nose too high. You can't lower the nose too much. You can't tilt the wings in a bank too steeply. You can't go too fast or too slow. You can't pull too many G's. On this flight, we never did any of those things. So in this particular case, those things didn't help us. What it also will do, and I'm trying not to get too technical here, is it will, more than a conventional airplane, more or less stay where you point it. And that gives you a little bit of time to think about other things. So that may have helped a little bit. In certain ways, it actually made a few parts of the flight slightly more difficult. Without getting too complicated again, in a fly-by-wire airplane, one does not have the tactile feedback when speed changes, and the control force can be felt on the stick as with a more conventional airplane. So you don't have that, without looking at the instruments to see what's happening, you don't have that sense, of that feel of the airplane. And there is some question I'm understanding now about the last few seconds of the flight on January 15th, about how the flight control system performed that the NTSB is looking at. But I'd say overall it was not a big factor that day.
What is your favorite kind of airplane to fly and why?
Of the ones I've flown or that I would like to fly?
Well, both. Let's the ones you have flown first. And
well,
then
I haven't flown that many times, but I'd say still Head and Shoulders above all the rest in terms of my pure enjoyment of it. It had to be the F-4 Phantom. It was a jet fighter. And, I was flying as a fighter pilot in the Air Force in the 70s during the Cold War, so much of what we did was to practice flying in formation at ultra-low altitudes and very high speeds. And it was exciting. It was something that was very challenging. It was difficult to do well. It was very satisfying, very rewarding to be able to do it. It was exciting.
What about the plane you would most wish to fly that you've never gotten to fly?
Oh, I would love to have flown the Concorde. It's a shame there's nothing like it out there now.
Will there be again, do you think?
Gosh, that's difficult to say. You're asking the wrong guy. My stock picks haven't been that good even. So, I hope so. It seems like everything is about the bottom line. Everything is about the money, and that was so economic a vehicle, even though it was a magnificent airplane. I would love to have flown the SR-71. That too is gone. And way back, I would love to have flown the X-15, and those of you of a certain age might remember that, the rocket-powered experimental flight vehicle that flew out of Edwards Air Force Base back in the 60s. It went to Mach 7, went to 350,000 feet, I think. It was.
I'll let you tell us about that.
Almost
a spacecraft.
I don't think you want to be on that. But it's that kind of stuff that gets me motivated. In fact, I was going to digress just for a second,
sure,
talking about one of the people who did fly those airplanes, I think, was Neil Armstrong. Mm-hmm. You may have heard that name before. And one of the things he said just recently that I read about a few months ago was that, of course, he had a crew of three, and they went to the moon. But he said there were 100,000 people who helped him get there, contractors and other people working on this project for nearly 10 years in Apollo. And he said what got them all motivated, what got them out of the bed and got them going in the morning and probably got them started in their careers was three things. He said, the wonder of science, the beauty of mathematics, and the precision of engineering. Mm. And to that I would add only the freedom of flight.
Terrific. A couple of technical, not too technical, but I know a lot of people speculated after this, and I don't know that I've ever heard an answer from the audience. Why isn't there something in front of an engine, a net or a screen or something that can prevent birds or other debris from going into the engine?
Well, you know, a lot of people have wondered about that. In fact, I've gotten letters from lots of them, complete with drawings sometimes.
Very helpful.
And I'm sure somebody somewhere has considered that and looking at that. But, of course, one of the things you have to consider is the airflow into the engine, and we have to fly in all weather, including icing conditions, and it wouldn't help very much if there was a screen that would ice up and prevent air from getting into the engine. So, I mean, it would have to be done very well or heated or something to that effect. And I think anything in front of the engine that disrupts the airflow is very costly in terms of its operation. So I think that they're considering all kinds of possibilities, but I don't know that screens would work.
All right. here's something that you and I had talked about once before, which surprised me, and it may surprise this audience. The relationship that you and Jeffrey Skiles had in the cockpit those few minutes during the crisis was, you know, one hand knowing what the other was doing and a terrific cooperative effort. You two had never met prior to that flight. Is that right? Never flown together.
Prior to that trip.
Prior to that trip. You'd never flown
together. We met 3 days before this happened.
But you never flown together.
We had never flown together. I had never seen him before Monday of that week.
Which is fascinating because you worked together in such a cooperative way and an instinctive way as if you... My impression was in the weeks afterward that you guys were flying partners many times. And that was not
Well, we're certainly brothers now. We and many of those who are on the airplane, I said at one of the early meetings back in February that 60 Minutes had arranged. They had asked me to say a few words, and I said that we're joined forever in our hearts and minds because of this event. But, I think what that tells you, and most people may not know about the airlines, is that if you work for a major airline, it's not unusual at all to fly with somebody that you've not only not flown with, but perhaps never met. And the fact that we can do that and do it so seamlessly tells you to what a high professional standard we're all trained so that we become essentially interchangeable. And it would never be allowed now, especially since September 11th, for you to actually watch us work. But if you could get a kitchen pass from the FAA administrator and sit in the jump seat in the cockpit and watch us, you couldn't tell if I was flying with somebody for the first time that we hadn't been flying together for years.
What's the key to the dynamic of that relationship? Who controls, I guess it would be the captain, controls the emotion of the room? In other words, if you sit next to a guy who is a chatterbox and a jokester, and that's not your personality.
The captain certainly sets the tone, and that's one of the things that we teach, you know, is how to, when you first meet the crew, have a brief briefing, a get-together, I have two minutes to do some really important things. When I first meet my entire crew, we get on the airplane, usually standing in the aisle in first class, and we talk about a couple of things just for 2 minutes, especially if we haven't met before. But even if we have, just to review, I try to quickly set the tone, establish some credibility, reassure them that I want the same thing to happen for the next 3 or 4 days, whatever the length of our trip is that they do, to make it as good and as safe as we can to get home in time, the last leg. And to give them what they need to do their jobs and to help them with that. And then I try to throw in a little bit of humor. I'll often say, well, I can't get you your pension back, but I will work very hard to get the hotel band there for us so we don't wait 20 minutes when we get to the airport, the last leg. And I think they respond that way. If you do it right, if you work together to build that team, then it pays big dividends.
How has the relationship you've had with U.S. Airways changed as a result of this? This is from the audience. You don't fly a full schedule.
No, I can't fly a full schedule because of all these amazing opportunities and other obligations I have now. I should digress a second also and tell you that within a few days of us landing in the Hudson, when it first became apparent to me and Jeff Skiles that this story was going to be as big as it's turned out to be, when we first got the first inklings, because we weren't watching the media, we were busy and we were getting reports about what was going on, what was being said, we felt an intense obligation to, since we were chosen by circumstance to be essentially the face of the profession, the spokespersons for the profession, to do a good job of it and not disappoint our peers. And I think the companies recognize that, and they too know that this is a big story and that there's an advantage to having us still associated with them. And so they've been very flexible about letting us do all these appearances and other obligations.
Do you suspect that will continue in your case? Are they?
I think so. I get every indication that it will. At some point, I'll have to spend more time working on specific company-specific projects after the book tours is more complete. But I think they'll continue to be cooperative as they have in the past.
You testified before Congress about the airline industry. This is from the audience. Do commercial pilots in today's industry get sufficient rest and time off?
You know, there are some cases where we don't. And that's one of the things that we need to do, we need to fix. We're living with decades-old rest rules, or rules that were written generations ago in a different world at a different time when on the short haul flying into the scale, pilots weren't flying as many flights per day as they do now. And on the long haul into the scale, the technology did not yet exist to have 15 or 16-hour nonstop flights to Mumbai. And so at both ends of the spectrum, the rules are out of date. We have the science. We have the data. We know what needs to be done. It's time for us to act on it. But just as any other problem you have in a democracy, it requires two things: public awareness and political will to change it. And so now we have a fairly new FAA administrator, Randy Babbitt, who is a retired airline pilot who used to be the president of the Airline Pilots Association, the largest pilot union in this country. And so we're hopeful that some of these issues will be addressed. But there are those out there who have other needs and desires and agendas, and they're going to try to keep a lid on the cost side. Mm-hmm. But to give you an example, we have some trips where you'll have what we call a minimum overnight in it. And one of the nights you'll have 9 hours, 15 minutes off, and I say off in a loose way, from the time you arrive at the gate in the evening at the end of your flying day until you're required to depart from the gate the next morning. Now, if you do the math, and I have, and you factor in how long it takes to deplane an A321 that's full, about 15, 20 minutes, and then get your bags and walk to the curb another 10 or 15 minutes, and then wait 20 minutes for the van to pick you up and take you 30 or 40 minutes to the hotel, and then you get your room, and maybe the key doesn't work the first time, and then you get to your room, and you call home, and you get something to eat, and you go to bed, and you get up in the morning, and you're getting 5 or 6 hours of sleep. And it's scheduled that way, and they know it is. And so what we're all relying on is that, yeah, you'll be tired, but maybe the next day you get some more sleep. And so what we're also relying on is that when a crew is particularly fatigued, if they've had a really long day and they're more tired than usual, that the captain will say, okay, time out, we're going to delay this flight, or we're going to do something else, and we're not going to leave that early. Well, see, my point is that safety is too important to be managed by exception. It should be scheduled so people can get 8 hours of sleep.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Captain Chesley Sullenberger, the commercial pilot who safely and amazingly landed his plane in New York's Hudson River in January of 2009, earlier this year. Sully, is there one thing in your life that helped prepare you for the moments of Flight 1549? Is there anything that you look back on as being the salient thing that prepared you for that moment in time?
I don't think there's just one thing, and in fact, that's why I keep coming back to everything I've done helped me in some small way. But if I had to pick one thing, I would say, I would say three things. My passion for it at an early age made me work hard to be the best I could be. My curiosity made me a lifelong learner. And just after all these years of doing this job, I never had the caring beaten out of me.
Hmm. Still love it.
Still love it.
Yeah. And with that, Sully, I'd like to shift focus for the remainder of the program about the events after that day and how your life has changed and how you've had a chance to reflect on some things about what this story says about the country. But first, let me start with how you and your wife, Lori, have coped with this national and international celebrity that you were suddenly thrust into.
Well, this did happen to all of us, and it happened to both of us. And another way, I was very fortunate that I guess it was one of my best preparations for this, besides just living my life in a thoughtful way, was having a partner who was so supportive and so smart and articulate. And because I had help, I had my union brothers in New York to help me the first few days, and Lori was essentially alone at first until her girlfriends showed up and handled this onslaught with 350 media requests a day and satellite trucks in our house for 10 days, people knocking on the door, looking in the windows, calling my kids' cell phones. Not Dan.
I never looked in the window.
Not Dan.
I may have called once or twice.
So it changed our lives instantly, in an instant, in every way. And we've had to work very hard to try not to let it change us too much, but we certainly have had to learn a new way of living our lives because this life is different than the old one.
Is it, I won't say better, but is it as good? It's obviously different. Are you enjoying this experience?
We are now. We are now. This is better. But it took a while to get here. I mean, it was disruptive. It was stressful. It was just hard. But I mean, it's. I keep telling my kids that it's this incredible gift of people's gratitude to us, and it's the power of this story that has fueled these amazing opportunities. Mm. And I keep coming back to having a greater voice and having more ways to make a difference. And I talk in the book about before January 15th, I felt like maybe at the end of my life, after spending decades doing lots of things that maybe helped a little bit from day to day, that in aggregate, at the end of my life, it would have added up to be a sufficient mass that I would have made a difference for having lived. And I was okay with that. You know, but now, of course, people will remember me for January 15th. But if I'm lucky, and if I do a good enough job at it because of the attention paid to this story and people's fascination with it and how moved by it they are, maybe I can find other ways to do good and right wrongs, and it may be that my greatest contributions still lie ahead.
Which I suspect, Sully, is one of the reasons that you have not only been so willing to tell your story, but to tell the airline's story and to talk about safety and to talk about concerns, which I suspect prior to this event was not easy to do, and maybe you didn't have the platform on which to do it.
Well, I did it. It's just nobody listened. Except the poor guys I was flying with. But they felt the same way I did. I mean, I think it would be difficult to do this job for 30 years and not feel the way that we do about it. I mean, we care about it. I mean, if I didn't care, it wouldn't matter so much, but it does matter.
You've had so many unique experiences. You were introduced to the Super Bowl. You went to the White House for the inauguration. You're doing the Rose Bowl parade this year. You know, suddenly the life of a rock star from cockpit to center stage. Are you having fun with this? Are you enjoying it?
I am. You got to realize what a 0 to 60 in a nanosecond ride this was. One of my chapter titles is The Wild Ride, and that's what it's been. It's been a wild ride. And at first it was simply overwhelming, and then it felt surreal. It was hard to believe the event had happened, and it was hard to believe this was happening as a result of it. But, yeah, you come to terms with it, and you get better at it. You either sink or you swim. And so I've worked just as much just as much as I cared about flying, I cared about doing this ride as well. And so I've worked very hard to become better at this part of it and to become the kind of spokesperson that my peers expect me to be and that they need me to be.
Right, but you've been conscious of that.
Yeah, and so I think what's helped me the most is I've learned to have some fun with it. I've learned to kind of lighten up and enjoy it. And I've really had to make a mental shift in my attitude, and that is to be energized by it and not be so used up by it.
Interesting.
And that was the key for me, finally.
What is the... there was a interview years ago that Ted Koppel did with Bruce Springsteen, and he said to Bruce Springsteen... Ted Koppel loved rock and roll music, and he said to Bruce Springsteen, you know, when you go out on stage, people just go crazy about you, over you. They're enthralled. They're overwhelmed. What is that like to experience? And his answer was, well, I suppose it makes you kind of tough to live with. How has this trying to, because you're a grounded fellow and you have a grounded family, how has this changed you, or has it?
I think it has to. As much as we try to be true to ourselves, I think it does. I certainly had to be more comfortable assuming this role. It's like a new job. I had to get better at my new job. But I know it's a good job and it's an important job. And so if part of my new job is being the public face of something that makes people feel so hopeful, then that's a worthwhile thing to do. Lori will tell you, and she's very good about keeping me grounded, that sometimes it is hard. And I think what was especially hard, I've gotten a little bit better at it lately, is finding the right balance between family and everything else, especially when now there's so much everything else. And there are some days, quite frankly, that I shouldn't be Sully. I should simply be Kate's dad or Kelly's dad or Lori's husband. And so I'm getting better now, just yesterday, as a matter of fact, by saying no more and saying not now, this is family time, or maybe later at the end. You have some other thoughts about that? Let me tell you.
Lori's shaking her head in the audience.
Let me tell you a quick. Let me tell you a quick story. This in the book too. So on January 20th, the inauguration. 5 days, our heads are still spinning. You know, we're still in trauma. 5 days after the emergency landing in Hudson, we're at the inauguration. The girls had to go shopping and buy dresses that were appropriate. They didn't have any. I had to borrow a tux and an overcoat. I didn't have one. I had one suit for weddings and funerals, and it didn't look good enough. And so we meet the president and first lady. It's incredible. We're told just to expect a quick dash, and instead he's very gracious and generous with his time. He's there for 10 or 15 minutes. At one point, turns to my wife, and the president says, "So you're not letting all this go to his head, are you?" And being the good partner she is, she immediately and forthrightly responded, "Well, people may think he's a hero, but he still snores."
And there's something very real and very charming about that story and that reality. And I think the reason Lori has told that story is because she wants people to know, correct me if I'm wrong, that yes, he did a remarkable job that day, and he was in fact a hero. But you're an ordinary man trying to do the best that you can. And that's true, I think, in everyone's life, to do the best. You talk about highest duty in the book, the title of your book. What is the highest duty in your judgment?
Well, it's certainly to take care of each other. And I've always felt a great responsibility to do that. In fact, it was a choice I made. One of my chapter titles is also Showing Up for Life. And I relate the story of March 1964, New York City, Kitty Genovese. And I was 13 when I heard about that story, where apparently, allegedly, a young woman was attacked and murdered in view of her neighbors and over a period of time and cried for help. And I found it shocking and distressing that such a thing was possible. Growing up in rural North Texas, it seemed inconceivable to me that such a thing could happen. It angered me. And I made a promise as a 13-year-old that if I were ever in a situation where I could help someone who needed my help, I would choose to do so.
At 13, you made that decision.
At 13.
We have time for a few more questions, and I want to ask you to reflect on this past year. We've had so many serious stories in the news, disastrous stories in the news. As you look back at this last year and how America and Americans have gravitated to you and to this story, what does it say about us?
Well, one of the reasons I wrote the book was to answer for myself and by extension for the reader that question. What was it about this amazing story, this remarkable outcome that made people feel the way they do about me and about the story? And I think it happened at a time when people needed it. It happened at a place where people remember where they were when they saw it, heard it. I think it gave people hope. It reassured them that maybe we still are the country that we thought we were, that we hope we will be. I think it renewed people's faith in humanity. I think it reminded them of the potential for good that still exists, not only in the world, but in each of us.
Final question, and I've asked Sully this question before. He's had a year to think about it now. Who is going to play you in the movie?
Oh, my goodness. It's going to have to be somebody who doesn't look a whole lot like me, probably, if there is one, but we'll see.
Our thanks to Captain Chessy Sully Sullenberger. Our thanks to Captain Sullenberger, who has put his story and his profession in the national consciousness, author of the new book, Highest Duty, and the man many have called a modern-day American hero, and he is surely that. We also want to thank our audience here and on radio for being with us. Tonight's program has been part of the Charles and Louise Travers series on ethics and accountability. I want to remind you that immediately following the program, Captain Sullenberger will sign copies of his new book outside this room, so please do allow him to get to the book signing table as quickly as possible. I know you'll all want to speak with him, and he will be delighted to speak with you, but just give him a moment to get to the back. I'm Dan Ashley, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.